Turn with me to Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23. It's Friday morning. Weekend's coming. And I'm not sure if it's appropriate or not, but I mean this in a non-blasphemous sense. Thank God it's Friday. But in a very different way than the world would suggest. I have a book in my library, it's entitled The Weekend That Changed the World. There ain't no weekend you ever experienced like the weekend that is now before us. It's early Friday morning. The sun is rising. I don't know if you are a morning person or a nighttime person. I'm a morning person. I like sunrises. Like dawn, it's crisp, the day's beginning, there's a backup at the tunnel. No, you try to miss that, but dawn. It's somewhere between 6 and 7 a.m., 6:30. It has been an awful night. There have been three trials to this point, the trial of Jesus of Nazareth, two of them completely illegal, the third one partly illegal, two at night, the home of Caiaphas and Annas, the high priests, or the former high priest and the current high priest, and then a quote-unquote legal trial at dawn, where they finally got Jesus to admit, at least in their way of seeing things, that he in fact claims to be the King of the Jews and for added measure, the God, divine. There has been beating. There has been mockery. This is far from, as I said, any form of legality here. Jesus has not had any sleep. I don't know. I have never stayed up all night. I remember when I went to university, I could study to 10 or 11 and I could go no further. But there would be people, especially when it came to paper time, they would pull all-nighters. I couldn't do it. But some people have that ability. Well, Jesus has been through an all-nighter, but not like that. So you know what it's like who have stayed up all night and it's the dawn is breaking. For those of you who have experienced that, you are dead tired. Add that to the stress Jesus has gone through, knowing what he is facing, and the abuse that has been hurled upon him and the beatings that he has already undertaken. He's already finished. We left off at the end of chapter 22 with the necessary grounds being established for his death. It included, again, both treason and blasphemy. The religious leaders have what they want. We now move on to chapter 23, and we want to read the first 25 verses. Luke 23, we're at verse 1. Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." And Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "You have said so." Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. But they were urgent, saying, he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee even to this place. When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him because he had heard about him, and he was hoping to see some sign done by him. So he questioned him at some length, but he made no answer. The chief priests and the scribes stood by, vehemently accusing him. And Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before this they had been at enmity with each other. Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people. And he said to them, you brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will therefore punish and release him. But they all cried out together, away with this man and release to us Barabbas, a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city and for murder. Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus. But they kept shouting, crucify! Crucify him! A third time he said to them, why? What evil has he done? I have found in him no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish and release him. But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed. So Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked. But he delivered Jesus over to their will. Crucify him. Crucify him. The most awful words ever uttered by man. Kill God. Kill him. There are three scenes in this ongoing trial of Jesus. We have already been to three of them. Two again in the court of the religious leaders and one in the official court of the religious leaders. Now we move into the political realm. The court of the Romans. And I want to focus upon these three scenes, and then more particularly through three individuals or three groups which lead to the death sentence of Jesus. It's this final scene of the six trials that finally lead him to the cross. Scene one. I would have you see the irresponsibility of Pilate. The irresponsibility of Pilate in verses 1-7. We read in verse 1 of chapter 23 that the whole company of them arose and brought him now before Pilate. What the religious leaders attained in the previous chapter, or what they desired, they attained. Simply to get Jesus to admit, at least in their understanding, that he in fact was claiming to be the Jewish king. But they had no jurisdiction with respect to the death sentence. They could drum up charges and they could get proclaim things, but they had to go to the Roman authorities in order to get Jesus crucified, to have him killed. They had no ability, they had no legal means by which they could carry out what they wanted. Only the Romans could do that. That's actually stated for us in John chapter 18. In John chapter 18 and verse 31, Pilate says to them, "Take him yourself and judge him by your own law." The Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." So they had one step yet to hurdle over. The step of getting the Roman authorities to agree to what they wanted. They had orchestrated a charge, but they now had to convince the civic powers. And I would remind you that they are in a hurry. Everything about this is a fiasco because they had one thing in mind. It didn't matter about the legalities of this, but they wanted to get this done before too many people got up and figured out what was going on. They didn't want to give this time to simmer where anybody would have any second thoughts. This is mob rule. So they hustled Jesus over to Pilate. Now, who's Pilate? Pilate is the ruler of the province of Judea, where Jerusalem sits. He ruled from AD 26 to AD 36. He was known for his many acts of cruelty, but that wasn't out of the norm. The job of these Roman puppet rulers was to make sure that the area that they were ruling over was kept peaceful, that the people were paying their taxes, and that law and order was, and you kind of did what you had to do to maintain civility in the area. Pilate did that. If you were a Roman ruler, you weren't a nice little pussycat. You were a tyrant. You yielded the sword and you ran the soldiers of the area. So the huge crowd moves from the high priest's residence to Pilate. Verse 2, and they began to accuse him, being Jesus, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." This mob comes running to Pilate. Dozens, if not hundreds of people charging to the governor's palace, creating a scene, an uproar, leveling accusations. And there are three of them. One, he's misleading the nation. They're accusing him of what we would call sedition, creating an uproar. He's getting the people to rebel against Rome. He's been preaching another kingdom. He's claiming to be a king. Remember, it was just a few days ago that there was the triumphal entry, and you see the people. This isn't good, Pilate. This is not good. Secondly, they accuse him of forbidding tribute. He's telling the people not to pay taxes. Back in chapter 20, right? They came to him asking a question, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And he said, well, give to Caesar. But somehow they twist that and he doesn't want you to pay taxes. And then thirdly, he's claiming to be king and that they had just found that out in the trial. They had again been twisting the words as they come to the Roman authorities. I would have you note something here. The basis of this accusation is governed by political spin and a distortion of truth. Nothing new about that, is there? This has always been twisted allegations. That is, I would have you remind us this morning, the way of the enemy. Typically, the devil or Satan or the enemy of our souls does not come with outright lies. He's a deceiver. He typically takes the truth, and as someone once said, twists it 20 degrees. 20 degrees. See, he's not the guy with the pitchfork. Ah! No, how is he described? He's an angel of light. It's close to true, but it's not true. Thus, false religions of the world, cults. Oh, we all worship the same God and we're striving for world peace. That sounds real nice, doesn't it? It's kind of true, but it's twisted. That's his way. He comes to Eve. He said, "Isn't that a good-looking apple?" It doesn't say apple, but don't come to me. It didn't say apple. No, I know it doesn't say apple. Isn't that a good-looking piece of fruit? It's desirable to make you wise. And God doesn't want you to know the difference between good and evil. So there's always shades of truth, but twisted. That's how he comes into our lives. And he wants us to compromise. Yeah, you know, it's not so bad, and you can justify that. And we know deep down inside, and you can make your own application. That's how he tempts. It tastes good. It feels right. It's loving. You wouldn't want to stop two people who love each other from and fill in the blank. Truth twisted. And that's what he does here. Jesus is making statements, and there's elements of truth to what they're saying, but they're completely out of context, and they're twisted. I would also have you see here, it's kind of ridiculous in that the Jewish leaders who are looking for their Messiah are going to the Romans and saying, "Oh, look at that guy. He's bad for Rome," as though they really care. Verse 3, Pilate asked Jesus directly, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Actually, it's in the original language, in the emphatic. Where you put the word in the Greek language determines the emphasis upon that sentence. And so what he's saying here, in fact, is, "You are the king of the Jews?" Why would he say that? Well, Jesus didn't look much like a freedom fighter. This guy's bloodied and beaten and been up all night and been accused, and he doesn't say, he's there and he's barely, "You are the king of the Jews. This is a joke." There's a more detailed account of this in John chapter 18, verses 33 to 38. So Pilate entered the headquarters, or his headquarters again, and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world." Then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say so. If that's what you say, that's the idea here." Pilate's not stupid. He looks at this guy. He has this conversation with Jesus, and he goes, This guy ain't no king, at least not in my understanding. He's no traitor. In Matthew, it says that he knows Jesus is delivered because of the envy of the religious leaders. These guys aren't stupid. And so in verse 4, he acquits Jesus. I find no guilt in this man. But verse 5 keeps the argument going. They were urgent. He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee even to this place. He knows the truth, but below the level, in the recesses of Pilate's heart is fear. He's fearful of not being able to control the crowd. And so he finds a way out of the responsibility that is his. Oh, you, Galilee. Is he Galilean? Ah, that's Herod's jurisdiction. And what do you know? Herod's in town. According to Roman law, he should have released Jesus. If you declare a person not guilty, the Romans had a pretty articulate legal system. And they played by the rules. Pilate is stepping, no, he's not so much stepping outside of the rules. No, he's deferring. He doesn't want to make the decision. He wants to stay clear of this. So he deflects, he avoids. He's not responsible. Later he will wash his hands of this whole affair, Matthew tells us. That's the first approach to Jesus in this text, is that of avoidance. I don't want to deal with him. Let somebody else deal with him. But you can't avoid him. Not my issue, he says. Irresponsibility of Pilate. Secondly, the curiosity of Herod. The curiosity of Herod. I made a typo. That should be 8 to 12 if you're taking notes. The curiosity of Herod. So Jesus is sent from Pilate to Herod. Herod is the ruler of Galilee, the area to the north. This is where Jesus had done most of his ministry, and Roman law stipulated that if the crimes were committed in the area the man was from, or if he was from that area, that the leader of that area, the head of that area, could try the individual. That could be their responsibility. So this is very convenient now. Herod's in town probably for Passover. Herod has some Jewish blood flowing through his veins, and he goes down there to kind of to get in the goods with all the people. So that's why he's in Jerusalem. Herod is the son of Herod the Great of Matthew 2 fame. Remember the Herod who slaughtered all the babies after Jesus was born? That was his dad. This is the ruler of Galilee, this Herod. He's otherwise known as Herod Antipas or Herod the Tetrarch, same reference. He's the guy who beheaded John. Well, in verse 8, it says that he was very glad to see Jesus. He desired to see him. Why? He wanted to see some signs because he'd heard about this guy. A little more background on Herod. Turn back to chapter 9 of Luke. Chapter 9, verses 7 to 9. He'd heard about Jesus, and it says, that when Herod the Tetrarch heard about all that was happening, and it says he was perplexed because it was said by some that John had been raised from the dead, by some that Elijah had appeared, and by others that one of the prophets of old had risen. Jesus is this reincarnation, he is being told. In fact, if you read Matthew's gospel, he says this to other people, I think he's John. So he's very curious. John I beheaded, but who is this about whom I hear such things? And he sought to see him. In Luke 13, Jesus calls him a fox because at that time he'd wanted to put Jesus to death. But he'd never met him. And he's curious. Pilate is irresponsible. He wants nothing to do with Jesus, but Herod is curious about him. He wants to see, it says, some sign. He wants to meet this magician, this celebrity figure, right? And now he gets a chance. It's like when, you know, who was it in town the other day? Concert. Pink. I'm really with it. I know who that is. And I realized that the eye is not an eye. It's a, what do they do? It's some, what is it? Yeah, whatever. Anyway. And she fills the arena. People want to, I've heard of. Marcel and I were in LaGuardia Airport in New York on Marcella. We went there for Marcella's 50th birthday many, many, many years ago. last year. That was terrible. No. Last year. I couldn't resist. I'm sorry. Anyway. Yeah. My 60th is coming next year, so we're going to quit. Anyways, aside from all that, we were going through LaGuardia Airport. And somebody says, you know who that is? I got a picture of her on my phone because I took a photo. Diana Ross. You can touch me later. And she was in a wheelchair. She'd broken her foot and something had, but you know, had to go through security like everybody else. We like to meet the important people. I'm so sorry, Marcel. I feel really bad, but anyway, I should. Now I'm going to hear the end of this one. But anyway, we met Diana Ross. Jesus is going to appear on the stage of Herod. He's happy. But Jesus does not respond to him. They tell us that Herod is the only person to whom Jesus said nothing. Jesus does not respond to curiosity. We had a little girl over at our place last week, and we have this. No, we were at my parents' place for my mom's birthday, and there was this little, my brother likes to buy these gag things, gifts. And there was this little stuffy, and if you push the foot, it's saying, happy birthday to, you know, one of those little, and so there was this little toddler we had that was over, and she was fascinated with this little foot. Push the button and sings. Push the button, sings. That's what Herod wanted with Jesus. Push the button, sing. Push the button. Jesus doesn't respond to the push the button, sing. Push the button, sing. Squeeze the foot. He's no celestial slot machine. He's no magic worker to satisfy our desires. Some of you hear, you know, why don't you just try Jesus? Jesus doesn't respond to trying him. We don't play with him. Well, this further agitates the religious crowd in verse 10. Because Herod says, I don't find anything wrong with him. They kept at it. Soldiers treat him, it says, verse 10, with contempt and mock him. So if he doesn't say anything, we'll just kind of ridicule him now. You see, again, Jesus is this puppet. It's his plaything. He knows the claims are false, and so he now mocks this king. Oh, it's your king? Yeah, and they put the robe on him, and big joke. It's a prop for his humor, which I would suggest is another perspective with respect to Jesus. He's a curious thing, but at the end of the day, he's a joke. Oh, and his followers are jokes too. He's the king. You worship a guy who was killed? We don't even know. You guys are nuts. This is silly. Where is this God? Where is this returning king? The curiosity of Herod. I thought to myself as I looked at these two individuals, Pilate and Herod, who thought they were so important. But they had no idea that they were playing or trying to avoid God. And you can't do that. You're either all in and you have to face him or you're not. There's no dancing around. Says in verse 12 that he now sends him back to Pilate. He doesn't want to deal with it either. He said, this isn't my authority. And now they become friends. They're actually paying homage to one another. No, you decide. No, you decide. And no, you've got more authority. And so it's interesting that how Jesus draws his enemies together. Because they want to nothing to do with him. So we have the irresponsibility of Pilate, the curiosity of Herod, and the depravity of the mob. The depravity of the mob. Verses 13 to 25. Back to Pilate. Pilate confers with the religious leaders now again. He negotiates. And again he says, I don't find anything wrong here. He's not guilty. And by the way, Herod didn't find him guilty either. I'll give him a good lashing and then I got to let him go. Again, Pilate is bound by Roman law. He didn't make the rules. So he's trying to find a way around them. I'll flog them. Many didn't survive, even the flogging. I'll spare you the details, only to say that they would take leather straps, a number of them, and they would put metal shrapnel at the end of the strap as they would whip a person. It's terrible. Well, that negotiating tactic doesn't work. They continue to demand the crucifixion, or what will ultimately be the crucifixion of Christ. Verse 18, they all cried out together, away with this man, and release to us Barabbas. A man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and for murder. And so he continues to as they talk to these people, they say, well, give us Barabbas, give us Barabbas. There's a story behind that, because every year they were allowed to release one prisoner to the Jews as a sign of goodwill at this time of the year, at Passover. And he says, would you like Barabbas? No, we want Jesus. He didn't want to execute Jesus. He continues to negotiate. He continues to try to avoid. By the way, in Matthew's gospel, in Matthew's account, it talks about his wife having a dream. And so he's even more afraid. He doesn't want to deal with Jesus. So maybe this is another way out. He wants nothing to do with this. He wants out, but he's stuck. But you can't not deal with Jesus. No one can not deal with Jesus. We're stuck. You got to deal with him. He's caught between the fear of acting in which case it would be illegal. And he knew that Jesus was innocent. Or not acting. And then he'd fire up the mob and maybe he'd get thrown out because he can't control the Jews. And so in verse 21, we hear those awful words for the first time. Crucify. Crucify him. And it says, now for the third time, he declares his innocence. But he's innocent. Stop right there just for a moment and contemplate that. Jesus was innocent. He's not the only one to have concluded that. In Matthew chapter 27 and verse 4, Judas says, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. In Matthew 27 verse 19, Pilate's wife says he's sitting in the judgment seat. His wife sent word to him, have nothing to do with that righteous man. Luke chapter 23, verse 15 says, again that Herod says he has done nothing deserving death. Verse 41, the thief on the cross says, we indeed are deserving this justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. Verse 47, the centurion saw what had taken place and says he praised God, saying, certainly this man was innocent. He was innocent. He did nothing to deserve this. In fact, he was without sin. Ever get accused of doing something you didn't do? And we know inside, this is not, I don't deserve that. And we get our backs up. Jesus didn't do, never mind, you know, getting a strap or something. He died for doing nothing. Innocent. But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified. And their voices prevailed. So Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder for whom they had asked, but he delivered Jesus over to their will. This is utter madness. And indicates the depravity and the depths of sin that are in the human heart, where even though a man is innocent, even though that God would come in the form of humanity, man wants him dead. And to this day, people want God dead. I don't want to submit to God. I don't want you to tell me what God says. I don't need, kill him. At least to the Christian message. We're no different. In Matthew, it says that Pilate, again, washes his the hands of this whole matter and gives to them Barabbas and says, I have nothing to do with this. And so Barabbas goes free. And Jesus is sentenced to death. As many of the commentators suggest, this is a microcosm of the gospel. It is the great exchange. An innocent man is sentenced and a guilty man is released. Barabbas for Jesus. But really, Barabbas is all of us. The cross that Jesus carries is Barabbas's cross. That's who it had been built for. But he took the place of Barabbas. He took the place of you and me. This is what we refer to in theological terms as the substitutionary atonement. He became sin for you. He took the place of the sinner, and the sinner was set free. The innocent condemned in place of the guilty. Pilate thought he could avoid Jesus. Herod thought he could play with Jesus. The Jews thought they could do away with Jesus. But we worship Jesus. There's one of four choices. I trust we all here this morning have made the appropriate choice. That we understand who Jesus really was and how we must respond to him. We want to remember again this morning the price that he paid on our behalf. Next Sunday, we talk about the crucifixion, where he gave of himself for us, he shed his blood for us. That's Barabbas's body. That's Barabbas's blood. But he took his place. That's my body. That's my blood. But he took my place. Let's spend a couple of moments in contemplation of this as we prepare now for the Lord's table.